Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know it?
Yes, indeed. We're going to have a Solartopia. That's the wonderful Dar Williams. We're back again. This is Harvey Wasserman. Introduced to you once again for the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show by the delightful, wonderful, powerful, and amazing Pete Seeger with the Grammy Award-winning song, Solartopia, co-written with David Burns, B-E-R-N-Z, who is a force behind the Friends of the Weavers and so much else. It's an honor to be introduced by that song, and it's an honor to announce today, or to remind everyone, that our great and wonderful friend Bonnie Raitt, truly a light into our lives, has won her 10th Grammy. It's astonishing, and what an amazing accomplishment. I don't know how many people have actually won 10 Grammys. She won it last night for in the Americana category. I guess they're really trying to diversify at the Grammy. I can't blame them, actually. It's a good strategy. And they put her incredibly wonderful album, Slipstream, into the Americana category, and she unexpectedly won, although I don't know why it would have come as a surprise to anyone who's heard that album, Slipstream. I can't recommend it highly enough. It is a brilliant, beautiful, very, very interesting, quirky, challenging, diverse album, Slipstream, that Bonnie did. She hadn't done an album, I think, since 2007 or so. She took time off and came back with this really amazing piece of work and won her 10th Grammy last night. I am so proud of Bonnie Raitt. She's been a stalwart of the anti-nuclear, pro-solar, environmental, equal rights, all the good causes that you can imagine. Bonnie Raitt has been in her camp. She's been giving. She's been forceful. She's been powerful. And she is just a spectacular musician, one of the greats, true greats of our generation of all time, really. Her father, of course, was John Raitt, the legendary Broadway singer, made a hit of Oklahoma and of Carousel, and then starred in The Pajama Game in from Hollywood. But Bonnie is just a transcendent talent and an incredible human being, and just really beyond all accolades. Anything you can, good you can imagine about Bonnie Raitt is true, and I just want to shout out to her for this 10th Grammy. In many ways, it's the most impressive of all, having to win 10 of these awards. I actually through the Solartopia song have a kind of strange back door to the Grammys. I wrote this song. I begged Pete Seeger, actually, on bended knee to write a song for Solartopia. I wrote a book called Solartopia. It's a vision of a green-powered Earth. And one day I was at Pete's house and just kind of, you know, how do you say it, humbly and pathetically and beggingly asked him if he might consider writing a song for Solartopia. He whipped out his banjo and said, sure, and he wrote a song within 5 minutes and asked me to write verses. And I was sitting there just banging out this doggerel. And he kind of looked at me and said, you know, finally said, keep your day job, son. A song is not an editorial. About a year later, David Burns, a wonderful neighbor, jumped in and wrote some really great verses, which you've been hearing as we opened the Solartopia song, show. And Pete liked them and performed, and they were making an album with the young kids in Beacon, New York. It became known as, they're called the Rivertown Kids, and with a KIDZ, and they made an album called Tomorrow's Children. And they very graciously put the Solartopia song on the album, and the album won a Grammy. So I'm going to ask the Grammy Awards people someday if I can actually have a statue. I'm sure they'll charge me like $500, but what can I tell you? So, but at any rate, the important thing now is that Bonnie Raitt has won her 10th. She continues to support our work. She continues to be a part of our work to save this earth. She is a true Solartopian. And I just want to be among the many to shout out to her in awe and thanks and gladness that she's won this award. So, Bonnie, we love you. Thank you for Slipstream and so much else. Norman Solomon, are you with us today?
Hey, Harvey.
Norman, how great to hear your voice. You sound loud and clear. It's fantastic.
I feel loud and hopefully clear.
Yes, indeed, you are. You are a beacon as well to all of us. Norman Solomon, I've known you since before you were born, and you and I co-wrote a book in 1982 that was published with Bob Alvarez and Eleanor Walters called Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation. You did really groundbreaking, very important work on the fate of atomic veterans, people who are downwind from atomic bombs. That was the part of the book you wrote, and your contributions to that book and so much else over the years have been impressive and important and all that stuff. And soon, of course, you're going to win a Grammy, right?
Well, I'm tuning up my voice, but I think meanwhile, you know, I've noticed that time does roll along, and so does the nuclear industry, but your Solartopia vision and reality and what you share, I've been sharing your book with people, and I think it's so important that we look at the, I don't know if it's, this is above my pay grade, if it's a yin or yang or what, but we look at the dark shadows of the nuclear era and also the bright sunlight of possibilities, and it's all real at the same time.
Yeah, it is. And Norm, we got a full hour here, and I know you have so much to talk about. Well, we can talk about that. We can start with that. The Solartopian vision of a green-powered Earth. What astounded me was that no one had done it before. I actually trademarked the word Solartopia because I didn't want somebody coming out and using the word Solartopia to describe a green-powered Earth that would include nuclear power. And I know for, that someone like, you know, would do that at some point. Like, not to put him down too harshly, but Stuart Brand or Patrick Moore would be a former Greenpeace who came out for nuclear power, that somewhere along the line someone would create a Solartopian vision that would somehow not be Solartopian because it would include atomic energy. You've been fighting nuclear power since God knows when. Tell us the moment you started, jumped in on this, on the nuclear power issue.
Well, I sort of bought, like so many people, into the we bring good things to life corporate vision of nuclear power because, hey, I was a studious kid, and, you know, Atoms for Peace, what's not to like? And I moved to Oregon in around 1970, and then up the Columbia River, down the Columbia River, the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant was being built. It was the biggest when it went online later in the decade, I think the largest light water reactor. And we had, some people may recall, a very environmentally trailblazing governor named Tom McCall. And he blessed the nuclear power plant. And I figured, hey, what's not to like? But I was working at as a volunteer at KBOO Radio, community radio in Portland, and a couple of people who I met came in, and I interviewed them, Lloyd Marbat and Eugene Rosalie, in the mid-1970s, and they had a very different view of nuclear power, and I started to listen. And the more I learned, I thought, you know, this is not what it's cracked up to be. So in the late 70s, I caught a positive flu called Seabrook fever.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And we decided, hey, if those folks, and I know you were in the thick of it there in New England, I thought if those folks can be occupying nonviolently and so effectively the Seabrook site, we actually have an operating nuclear plant in Oregon. Let's do nonviolent direct action there. And so in 1977, I began basically 2 years full-time in that effort.
Wow. So you were let's see, 77. So you've been in this for 36 years.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
Remember, Harvey, you at our invitation came to Portland and spoke to us at the Trojan Decommissioning Alliance. It might have been around 1978 at that point.
Yeah. And I remember hanging at your place and loving Portland, Oregon. And then you got involved in the story of the atomic veterans. Why don't you tell our listeners a bit? Because, you know, it hasn't gotten much coverage lately.
Yeah.
But you were a pioneer in writing about and exposing what happened to the soldiers who were themselves exposed to the atomic weapons testing. Tell us a bit about that, if you would, because it's faded from the headlines.
Well, you know, at first, I just thought nuclear weapons were something that was impossible to even have any effect on, and I was focused on nuclear power, and I began to hear people point out that the separation between the nuclear power and nuclear weapons industries were largely illusionary, and they were Siamese twins. They were the same basic fuel cycle for the most part, and so reluctantly I began to think about nuclear weapons. And of course, upriver at the Hanford Reservation is a huge monstrosity of reactors and hundreds of millions of gallons of various types of nuclear waste from the mostly military reactors there. And so in that process, I began to just write a little bit about nuclear weapons and went to Hanford. And then I got a call one day from a physician who said there's a veteran of World War II that you need to meet. And I did meet him. His name was Lyman Quigley. And in our book, Killing Our Own, he's very much in the first chapter. And I met him and many others who not only were exposed to nuclear weapons testing in Nevada and the Pacific, but as in his instance, he was a Marine sent into Nagasaki after World War II to, quote-unquote, clean up at Ground Zero a few weeks after the atomic bombing. And he, like so many, coming down with very unusual illnesses, often fatal, including, for some, multiple myeloma, bone marrow cancer. And so my vistas and understanding began to really widen. And I also need to give a lot of credit and shout out to the film Paul Jacobs and the Nuclear Gang, which made
by Saul Landau, is that right?
Yeah, Saul Landau.
Who still makes films. He's at the University of California in Santa Cruz. And
he does. As a matter of fact, we in Marin County worked on a special screening of that film just about a year ago at the Rafael Theater in San Rafael, and it was stunning because you know how your memories are. It was a film that was aired, as I remember, in 1978, and with great controversy, PBS put it on, and frankly, I'm not sure PBS would be that brave today. We have
wow.
so much cowardice at PBS. But at the time, despite the attacks from, what's it called, the Edison Electric Institute? I don't know if they're still around.
Yeah, well, no, they're now called, what the hell are they called? The Nuclear Energy Institute, I think, NEI.
And they went nuts, and they understood, I think, better than a lot of us did, certainly than I did at the time. They understood that to talk about nuclear weapons testing was a threat to nuclear power because of the emissions of so-called low-level radiation, the sensitivity, as Dr. Alice Stewart and others had documented at that point, in utero exposure and the X-ray machine that never gets turned off, not to mention the alpha and beta particles, et cetera, et cetera. So the net effect was that to make those connections was, I think, very energizing for the movement against nuclear power as well as the emerging nuclear freeze movement as well.
Yeah, and those were really important days. I mean, I think people wonder what impact they have. And, you know, as organizers, I mean, you and I are both writers, but we're also organizers. And the important thing, Jesse Jackson once said, to me, the important thing that to remember as an organizer is you have to remind the people that you're organizing that you can win. And the nuclear freeze movement, to put a kibosh on more nuclear weapons and, for God's sakes, the use of nuclear weapons, had an enormous impact, especially in the 80s when Ronald Reagan was just cavalierly talking about nuking the Russians. I mean, I remember that Helen Caldicott, the great anti-nuclear activist, who also has a show on PRN, by the way, was invited by Patty Davis, Reagan's daughter, to meet with him in the White House and talk about nuclear weapons. And Helen emerged from this meeting completely shaken by, you know, the cavalier attitude that Reagan seemed to have about the use of nuclear weapons. And I think that the freeze movement could very well have, you know, prevented the use of nuclear weapons. It certainly had an impact on their proliferation.
Yeah, it was really stunning that here the structure, which is inherently, can I use the word insane? I think it implies.
Yeah.
The structure is insane.
Please use the word insane.
One human being has the power in the White House to blow up the world, in effect. And I think we could politely say that Ronald Reagan was a bit thick as a brick, and it was not somebody with great insight. And yet, you know, the anti-nuclear movement did have the effect, you know, created so many different positive energies and understandings, including, and it was not that it was a great film, but on ABC, the film The Day After, Jason Robards, showing in very mild form what a nuclear war would mean to human beings. And it's my understanding that it actually upset Ronald Reagan. He sort of didn't get it. You know, even that mild version of the reality of nuclear weapons effects, I understand, had some effect on him. And so the policies, of course, were horrendous in building and developing more nuclear weapons. But still in all, it's just to say that, as the wonderful late historian and activist Howard Zinn was fond of pointing out, we don't know our effects, and we need to keep pushing.
Well, we you know, one of the great confirmation moments for me was reading, I couldn't stomach the whole thing, but I did read parts of Richard Nixon's autobiography.
Oh.
And in Richard Nixon's autobiography, he said that the anti-war movement prevented him from using nuclear weapons in Vietnam, that was the secret plan. When he ran in 1968 against Hubert Humphrey, he ran on a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. And the secret plan was to not drop nuclear weapons on Vietnam. But he said when he got in the White House, he was just, I won't say terrified. He was boxed in by the anti-war movement. And I'm sure you were, and I was involved in the anti-Vietnam movement from around 65 to the end of the war in 75. And my 10 years of activism, as there are yours and so many others, was confirmed. The value of what we did was confirmed by the idea that we stopped Nixon from dropping nuclear weapons in Vietnam. Can you imagine what the world would be like if Richard Nixon had used nuclear weapons in Vietnam?
Yeah, it's unfathomable, and a lot of the tapes verify that. He was very, as you say, he as well was cavalier, very flippant. And the continuum, and I think this is such a challenge for us, that generations evolve, and then there's a new generation and another, and the transfer of information, understanding history, none of that is automatic. And the bad news is it's largely left to the mass media and schools. And so we have this recurring cycle of, it's not even ignorance that's the problem. I think of the statement, and I still can't tell you for sure if it was Will Rogers or Mark Twain, said it's not what people don't know that bothers me, it's what they know that just ain't so.
That one I never heard before.
Disabusing people of what they already quote-unquote know is such a tremendous challenge, and it certainly is necessary for the media work we do, the organizing we do as well.
Yeah. Well, and you as a writer now, you have been involved. Well, let's talk first about your more recent campaign for Congress. You ran for the Democratic nomination to Congress in your district in Marin County, and you came very, very close to getting in the runoff. You ran as a Democrat, and tell us about the campaign, if you would, and what you learned from it.
Well, I went into the campaign feeling that whatever the results, it should strengthen social movements on the ground. And I also went in feeling that there was no point in running if there didn't seem to be a plausible chance to win. I mean, I, of course, believe in protests. I take to heart what the great media critic George Seldes said long ago, never tire of protesting. And I think that being in the streets is essential, and also that progressives have got to gain power because state power matters in government. And so it was that precept that led me really to run for Congress when, for the first time in 20 years, there was an open seat in the North Bay, north of the Golden Gate. It was a tremendous organizing challenge, and I've never been involved in something that complicated in terms of so many different dimensions, not just multitasking, but there was sort of a logistical, financial, messaging, organizational, and a sort of a psychic tornado necessity of trying to connect with people and understand what was going on. So long story fairly short,
We got time. You can tell us.
We had this for the first time, the new system in California, the open primary, in which the top two candidate vote-getters, regardless of party, advanced to the general election. And we had 12 candidates. And from the get-go, six of them didn't have a snowball's ghost of a chance, if a snowball can have a ghost, of advancing to the general election. But as luck had it, those six were all people who talked like they were from the left. And none of them, and I want to be respectful here, but none of them had a firm grip on political reality, and none of them seemed to have a field of vision wider than their own interest in self-expression. And, you know, to me, self-expression is good, but not the point if we're going to talk politically in terms of strategy. So, you know, the net effect was those six candidates ended up getting a total, when you add up they're all 1% and 1.2%, the six of them got 8.6% in total, and I missed getting through the primary by 0.1%. So it's an example of how I think we need to prioritize our collective energies in communities, not just for elections, but other things, so that we can have a strategic basis for what we do and how we put our time and resources in. As it turned out, there were only two Republicans out of 12 running, and so one of those folks squeaked through ahead of me by 175 votes because he didn't fractionate. The other Republican hardly ran a campaign, so they had a solid block of a minority constituency, and we had a fragmented set of splinters of a much larger constituency. It's a fairly liberal district, and my disappointments really included that I wanted the general election campaign. I was campaigning by the time of the primary, 18 months nonstop. And basically, the guy who was sort of the quasi-incumbent, he was termed out of the legislature, had the Democratic Party establishment behind him. Jared Huffman was very similar in politics to Barack Obama, and supported some good things, and basically went along to get along with the military-industrial complex, and supports cap-and-trade rather than a tax on carbon, just sort of the traditional corporate Democratic Party stuff. And I think that position is something that is leading us, not as fast as the Republicans, but still leading us to disaster on many fronts. So I was disappointed to not have that 5 months between the primary and the general election campaign to really have a debate and challenge that kind of politics directly.
And did he subsequently, what's his name, did he subsequently win the seat?
Oh, yeah. I mean, once the result was that he was running against a Republican rather than me, he had it all locked up, Jared Huffman. So he's now in Congress, and unless he decides to do something else, like go to Wall Street, he will be in Congress for 10 or 20 years, I think, because it's just a solid Democratic district.
Ah. And did the Republican run any kind of race against him?
No, it was just sort of pathetic.
Well, that's too bad. You would have been a great congressman. I was looking forward to being your energy czar. So.
Well, you know, I really appreciated you were out in the district, and you mentioned Bonnie Raitt. Bonnie's wonderful, lives in this area, and was just so giving to our campaign. And we also had other people who you and I both worked with, like Sean Penn, Phil Donahue was out here, Jim Hightower, Dennis Kucinich came out and campaigned alongside me right before the primary. And most important, hundreds and hundreds of volunteers. I was just really struck by the combination of commitment, idealism, and generosity, and hard work. What a combination.
Yeah, yeah. And you were a great candidate. I mean, I did have the opportunity, as you say, to speak out there for you. And well, are you going to run for anything else?
Well, first, thank you for all that and the great energy you put in. And I'm not sure on that count. I really want to run for any political office only if I think there is a plausible chance to win. Like, I believe in protest, but I want to quote the great dialectician Mr. Natural from use the right tool for the right job. And I think that's that's there. I do want to mention, because I neglected to, somebody else who was here, somebody of course you've worked with very closely for decades, campaigned for me, sang for me in Mill Valley right before the primary election, Jackson Brown. And just tremendous, as you know, generous of heart and spirit and tremendous talent. And so looking ahead, we have something called the Coalition for Grassroots Progress, and I've always felt that a campaign, win or lose, should serve as compost to grow the next campaigns and help movements grow. And so that's what we're doing here. And frankly, we're looking for strong candidates for legislature, county board of supervisors, perhaps for Congress. And if anybody wants to look in on our site, the Solomon for Congress campaign and site have been transformed to grassrootsprogress.org, and we're doing a lot of organizing.
All right, grassrootsprogress.org. There you go, Norman Solomon. Norman, we're going to continue with you for the second half hour. You've got about a dozen books you've written over the years. You also went with Sean Penn to Baghdad prior to the war, in the Iraq war that George W. Bush cursed this nation and Iraq with. Did you go with Sean Penn to Haiti?
No, I didn't. I ended up going with him to Iran as well later on.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that when we come back. We'll run some music here. Maybe your good buddy Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia, the Rocky Top version. And when we come back after the break, we'll continue with Norman Solomon, my good buddy, co-author of the book Killing Our Own. Killing Our Own, by the way, is free. On the web. I got an email one day saying, I love this classic internet story. We've posted your book, Killing Our Own, free on the web. We hope you don't mind. I love that. And Norman Solomon talking to us from Northern California, Matt, if you want to run the music, we'll be back after this break.
Windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaics, everywhere.
All right, the great Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. We're on with the wonderful Norman Solomon, my buddy for almost 40 years, or about 40 years. A legend in the not only in the anti-nuclear movement, but in the media, pioneering fairness in media department. Norman has done spectacular work. Before we get to that, Norman, you're talking to us from Marin County, California. You struck up a friendship with Sean Penn, somebody I've tremendously admired for his work in the movies. He's made some amazing movies, including one, I Am Sam, which my kids really were blown away by. I've loved him in many, many films. He made Milk, very gutsy, playing a gay, the gay pioneer. And I was astounded when he took on that role. But you went with him to Baghdad on the eve of the war with Iraq. Can you talk about that experience and what it was like? Not just from a celebrity point of view, but I was astounded that you went as well. I mean, what a gutsy thing to do. So tell us about that, if you would.
Sure. Well, I'd been working with colleagues at the Institute for Public Accuracy, which I founded, and we got rolling in the late 90s, And so we were tracking, I was working with Sam Husseini there out of our D.C. office, to look at the lies that were being laid down by the Bush administration. And, of course, after 9/11, we had this invocation of the war on terrorism, and so-called. And, you know, you and I, Harvey, and so many others have the experience of seeing the escalation of the war in Vietnam, the war on Vietnam, based on deception. And so as we scrutinized what was going on with the agenda building for a war on Iraq, I mean, I was horrified. And I remember in the late spring and early summer of 2002, I was thinking, you know, I'm feeling pretty burnt out. I want to try to take some time off this summer. And then I realized that the war drums were beating louder and louder with the purpose of an invasion. And at that point, I remember seeing a news article that the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein had invited members of Congress to come to Baghdad for 3 weeks, ostensibly to look for nuclear weapons, but of course that was a silly part. They weren't experts on that, but invited them. And instead of seeing it as the door being opened slightly, the Congress and the White House leaders, so-called leaders, just made fun of it. You know, we're not interested in going to Baghdad. And I thought, well, why not? I mean, isn't it better to start talking and have dialogue rather than just escalate the threats leading to war? And so in September of that year, 2002, I organized and went on a trip to Baghdad, the first time that a member of Congress sitting in the Congress had gone to Baghdad during the administration of George W. Bush. And
which congressman came with you?
Yeah, that was Congressman Nick Rahal
from
West
where?
Virginia. And he's been in Congress for a very long time. And so he went with me, and also former Senator Jim Abaresque, who I'm sure you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Wonderful former U.S. Senator
from South Dakota, yeah.
And so they had served together on the Hill, and they went. I went with those two and Jim Jennings from the group Conscience International. So that was the first time I went to Baghdad. I didn't know from nothing, but I researched it and figured out, you know, how to get there, and we contacted the government. And frankly, this hasn't been talked about, but the Bush administration tried to prevent us from going.
How did they do that? What did the Bush administration do to try and keep you from going?
They told Congressman Rahal they didn't want him to go, and they wouldn't give him permission. And I remember the day that we were all going to our respective airports, he got a call from the State Department saying, essentially, well, since you're going, you can go, because he was going anyway. And so, you know, there were sort of some travel embargoes. You weren't supposed to spend money there. But going with the congressman, we were sort of insulated from all that. So anyway, we went. We met with Tariq Aziz.
Tariq Aziz?
Yeah, the former foreign minister, second in command of the Iraqi government under Saddam Hussein at the time. And about 48 hours after our meeting, the Iraqi government announced that for the first time in 4 years, they would allow UN weapons inspectors back in the country. I'm not claiming, Harvey, that there was causality, but I'm just noting the simultaneity of it. And it certainly doesn't hurt and does help when you have some dialogue going on.
Norman, how many people were in your delegation in this first trip? Was this the first trip by Americans to Iraq in the lead up to the war?
First trip by congressmen, American congressmen.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so there were four of us total, Abaresque, Rahal, me, and Jim Jennings. And so I came back, and I was excited that we had made, we thought, some impact. And I began to check around with other members of Congress because part of my hope, which I didn't say publicly, was if we could keep putting members of Congress in Baghdad, it would dissuade Bush from bombing the city while they were there. So I just wanted to have a continuous stream. But then in October, you had Dick Gephardt, the Democratic leader in the House, and other Democrats caving in. And by the way, John Kerry, one of them, caving in, voting for war, as Hillary Clinton did. And the atmosphere really changed. And members of Congress who had been talking with us about possibly following up on the trip they went cold. The doors are really closed. And I thought, well, you know, if we can't get members of Congress, who can we get with the stature and impact? And I began just casting the net widely, and I sent a letter to Sean Penn because he had taken a full-page ad-out in the Washington Post questioning the rush to war that fall. And it was raining out here. It was very early December 2002. I pick up the phone that was Sean Penn's office, and then next thing I know, I'm talking to him. It turned out he lived only about half an hour drive from me, so that very evening I went over and talked to him about the prospective trip, and within a few days we were in Baghdad.
No, really?
Yeah.
Just a few days?
Yeah, and it's very...
You and him alone?
What's that?
It was just the two of you?
Yeah, we flew from San Francisco to Baghdad by way of Amsterdam and Amman, Jordan. The reason it was so fast was really, I would say, well, threefold. One is, you know, we felt a sense of urgency. The second is, Sean is, let's get it done. He's very thorough, and he's also, let's move. And the third aspect was that he had a film commitment that he felt totally obligated to fulfill. He needed to be in Tennessee within about a week to begin shooting of the film 21 Grams. And so he felt, you know, once he goes on the set, I mean, it would be foreclosing his possibility to go to Iraq. And once we talked, it was clear to me he had his feet on the ground, and I guess he felt that way about me. So it was then a challenge of how do we get there? And I knew some people in Baghdad from the previous trip, but there is this thing called visas. And
yeah.
And Sean's attitude was, well, let's go. And I said, yeah, let's do that. There is this necessity to get a visa. So we really just had to push and push. And I was on email a lot and phone. And we landed in Baghdad Airport. It would have been about, I think, December 13th, 2002. We spent 3 days there. We met with Tariq Aziz. There was a huge media uproar. And, of course, he was vilified at that point. Not only the Murdoch press, but others called him Baghdad Sean. And he conducted himself with tremendous integrity and sense of conscience. And as he said at the time, he told John Burns from the New York Times, who wrote actually a good article about the visit on the 16th of December 2002, Sean said, I don't believe that I will need in the future to make any apology for my journey here to Baghdad. And 10 years later, I could say that's absolutely right. I mean, the people who should feel shame are those who pushed us into war.
Well, I thought it was a hell of a brave thing that you and Sean did. Well, did you go back after that?
I went back another time in January of 2003. Again, all three trips sponsored by the Institute for Public Accuracy. And the third trip was with Dennis Halliday, the former assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, who really had been pushed out of the UN because he couldn't stomach the draconian sanctions that were causing so much suffering among Iraqi children and other people in Iraq.
Well, I thought it was a really gutsy thing you did. I think it had a tremendous impact. Of course, Sean Penn became a great hero of mine with his work in Haiti.
Yeah.
I mean, he just really poured heart and soul into that place. You could tell. I saw footage from him there. It was not a show. I mean, this guy was on the ground day after day after day.
Oh, it's real deal. I mean, he's been there now for much of the last years. And I think in Sean's instance, as is sometimes the case, the heart and compassion and connection to our common humanity that he brings to his work in film as an actor and director, it's also really expressed in the political work that he does.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I have to say, you know, you and I now qualify as geezers. I mean, we're elder states people, let's put it that way. And I teach at a university here in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm doing a unit on Native Americans. And I decided, I showed my class, I have an honors class, and I wanted to show them an actual Native American. And so I showed them a clip of Winona LaDuke, our friend, the great Native American activist, from the White Earth Reservation. And during the Bush years, she was on Colbert. It was a very cute sort of appearance by Winona LaDuke with Stephen Colbert. But in the lead up to it, Colbert showed a clip of George W. Bush and it talking about sovereignty. And my students, you know, now don't have any real memory of George Bush, George W. Bush. And they got on and their jaws were on the floor about how stupid he was. God, yeah. I mean, it wasn't, it's wrong to call him stupid, but he gave the impression of somebody who had absolutely no clue. And his discussion of sovereignty was embarrassing. You know, he couldn't define sovereignty at all. And of course, he had no clue of what he was doing in Iraq. And the Iraq War is one of the great catastrophes in all our lifetimes. What, $3 trillion? God knows how many people were killed. Accomplished absolutely nothing. And you were 100% right to go over there. And I was really impressed that you went with Sean Penn and that you guys had such an incredible impact. So thank you for that, Norman. I'm glad to be able to thank you for it.
Oh, well, you know, so much of what we are able to do is because of other people informing and inspiring us, and I like to think that you and I and so many others are part of that sort of daisy chain in a positive sense. I think of when I was a teenager, all the people who inspired me, I just to hear someone like Dave Dellinger or Howard Zinn as a young person, tremendously important for me. When I heard you speak in Oregon, you were very inspiring to me, Harvey.
Well, thank you, Norman.
The way in which we can keep, there is something very organic about it. You know, the earth has its cycles, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that one thing always stuck with me about speaking, you know, you go around, you speak to small audiences, and you wonder what the hell you're doing. I mean, travel all these distances. So I was talking to Jeremy Rifkin once. He spoke here in Ohio, and we're talking about the perils of the road. And Jeremy, for many years, didn't fly. And I told him once I flew from Miami, Florida, to Duluth, and I spoke to five people. And he said that in the time when he didn't fly, he took the train from Washington, D.C. to Denver and spoke to two people. And he said, but, you know, you have to give the whole speech because one of them might be a Gandhi. And so when I hear you were inspired by one of my early speeches, that's what I think. Kevin Camps, who was at NEARS, also heard me speak once in a speech I don't remember in Kalamazoo, Michigan. So you just never know. And to have the idea that I could have helped you become an anti-nuclear guy is greatly confirming. But here we go, Norman. You have, I'm looking at on your Wikipedia page here, and you have written or co-written about a dozen books, many of them on media. So tell us, give us the essence. You've been a real force in critiquing the mainstream or what I call the corporate media in this country. Give us. We only have 12 minutes left, so give us, if you would, a thumbnail of what the essence of your work has been all these years on media.
Well, I came at media as a journalist and an activist. I had that aspiration from early on. Of course, I think, Harvey, I used to go down to Three Thomas Circle when Liberation News Service was there.
Oh, my God.
Vicariously, because I was still in high school. I was just a little bit young to be able to engage directly, but I read Liberation News Service, and of course you were central to that entire LNS effort, and I learned that, hey, you don't have to write like you're an automaton for the corporate media, but I believed in journalism, and still do. And so I got some training, and I worked on Saturdays at the Montgomery County Sentinel in Maryland, which is a mainstream weekly. And I got my basic skills going and then began to freelance. But as a journalist and an activist, I thought, oh, the stuff we're being deluged with, so much of it is reliance on official sources. It's often inaccurate for that reason. And we need real independent journalism. And so as an activist at the same time, and I think so many people have this experience, when you work on an issue, you see how the coverage is just so terrible. The omissions, the sins of commission, all the ways that we, when we know about an issue, and I think this is true, for instance, about fracking now, you see some of the mainstream media coverage, and it just makes my blood boil, what's left out, what is ignored. And so the process of learning about something of great concern caused me to become a media critic. And I thought, well, we've got a challenge. We need to confront the mainstream corporate media and also build our alternatives. And I think today, you know, decades later, those are, in media terms, the imperative. We need to get our antenna up and build our capacity to critique media, get a sensibility out in the country where people are more skeptical, not cynical, but skeptical, and think for themselves and can deconstruct media and understand when they're being spun. And also we need to build alternatives, and that goes to what we're doing right now on an alternative independent radio program, to say we're not only going to criticize what is, we're going to create something much better.
Well, you've been a pioneer in that. I love the your most recent book, I guess, 2007. This listed here on Wikipedia. Do you have one since? But I love the title, May Love Got War. That's a wonderful title, and of course it's a very autobiographical book. Have you had one since then?
No, that's pretty much been it. You know, I when that book came out, I began to see some of the election work as something I should focus on. And I thought sometime of something Arthur Kessler said. He talked about going into a library and thinking, as an author, this is very discouraging. Look at how many books there are in the world. Does the world really need another book? And then after that, I read a quote from Upton Sinclair, who said in 1934, "Enough words. The world needs a deed." And so he ran for governor of California. The point is not to denigrate books, because I believe in them, and God help me, I may write a few more before I move along.
Uh-huh.
But it's just that the combination of reflection and action and thinking and reading and speaking and listening, it's all about this greater, hopefully, dialectical process, so we can enrich all that we do.
Well, I love your books. You write great stuff. But, you know, in this day and age with the Internet, it's a whole other world.
Yes.
I mean, the last books, I have not even bothered to go to a mainstream or a corporate publisher for years now. Just publish our own, put them out on the Internet. You know,
right.
And you are a master of the Internet. Tell us about you built a bit of an infrastructure, which is, really important with the your various institutions. You work with Jeff Cohn and Sam Husseini. Tell us the nature of those, if you would.
Yeah, I've come to feel that it's really important that we have our institutions, that we can have that continuity and, as you say, the infrastructure. And 15 years ago, I founded the Institute for Public Accuracy, and ever since Sam Husseini and Holly Einbinder have been really central to that. We really are essentially, for lack of a better term, we're pro bono promotion efforts for, at this point, we've done it for thousands of authors, activists, researchers, academics who are untethered from the corporate mindset and the corporate bank accounts, and who are willing and able to speak up, speak out, and go against the grain of conventional wisdom. So if people go to accuracy.org, they'll find all sorts of ways to find out info and analysis from folks who were able to shine some bright lights.
And also you helped with fairness and accuracy in reporting, is that correct?
I say in Dean Acheson's session, I was present at the creation. And Jeff Cohen and other folks founding FAIR, the Media Watch Group, back in the mid-1980s. So I've always been a gleeful fellow traveler there and associate of FAIR. And just I'm thrilled every time, really. When I go to FAIR.org or read their magazine extra, I'm so thrilled at what FAIR does and, you know, continues to do. And meanwhile, in the last couple of years, co-founding with Jeff Cohen the group RootsAction.org, which is an action arm, and really trying to build up a way of cohesive action. So we have a couple hundred thousand people who are active now, in that they've signed up, they'd signed up for actions. For instance, top of our website at RootsAction.org, if people want to, with a click of a mouse, within about a minute, send an email to their two senators to say, do not approve John Brennan as CIA director, it's easy to do.
Excellent. Now, you've also, your other books is called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Let's talk about Obama in the remaining few seconds. I hope someday, Norman, you'll come back on the show. We barely scratched the surface of your knowledge and your incredible history in making this a better world. But tell us what you think in the remaining few minutes about Obama. You had a really brilliant piece called Dr. King Gave Us a Dream and Obama Gave Us a Drone. So tell us about that.
Well, I feel tremendous disappointment in Obama. Not that I had hopes that he would be an all-out progressive by any means. I was an Obama delegate to the 2008 National Democratic Convention, but I think that he has sunk below any reasonable expectations. This guy's a huge problem, not as an individual, but the forces he's choosing to represent and continue to represent. I'd sort of summarize it this way. When he gave his inaugural speech a few weeks ago to begin his second term, and he said, "We need not accept the idea of perpetual war." And yet here's somebody who has normalized as a bipartisan presidential policy to have perpetual war under the rubric of the so-called war on terror. It's a classic split between the rhetoric, which sounds very lofty and inspiring, as did his inaugural, and the reality on the ground of policy. And so, as usual, you know, we need to separate wheat from chaff, support his few policies, frankly, that I think deserve full support. And we've got to really organize for the peace and justice and environmental protection that we need. And as you know, and you've been so outspoken and eloquent about this, Harvey, XL pipeline decision coming up, so crucial. And it's unclear which way he's going to come down.
Yeah, you know, I won't be surprised if he gives it the green light, and that's going to cause us a lot of problems. We've been talking with Norman Solomon, author of a dozen books, a true hero of the peace and justice movement, and author most recently Made Love Got War, War Made Easy. Prior to that, you made a film of War Made Easy also, I think. What are you working on now?
Pretty much Roots Action and Institute of Republic Accuracy, and I've resumed my weekly column after, I guess, a two-year hiatus. So every week that's going up on various websites.
Where do you post it?
It's on Common Dreams, as well as my own site, normansolomon.com.
Excellent. Well, Norman, you're a pillar of inspiration for all of us in the activist community. I do want you back on the show. The hour just absolutely flew by. Next week, we're actually going to talk to your co-author and mine, Robert Alvarez, about the nuclear weapons complex. Upriver from you, actually, the Hanford nuclear reservation just got a bad review from a watchdog organization, and we'll talk about that. Norman, it's been an honor to have you on, Norman Solomon, and we'll talk again soon. Thank you, Norman. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and we will see you next week again on the radio. Thank you, Matt, and all the crew of PRN for the usual spectacular job.